Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. Welcome, everybody. Anyone here for the first time? Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to anybody joining us online. Heather, welcome. Anybody else that's new? Welcome back to everybody else. Was thinking about how much, so all of Buddhism is about how we suffer and how we can possibly end suffering through our own efforts. Really all of Buddhism, the Buddha like over and over said, I only teach, people would ask the Buddha all kinds of esoteric questions and he'd be like, I'm not an astrologer. I just teach how we suffer and how we can end suffering. The truth of suffering and the causes of suffering and path to end suffering. And I was thinking about how much, and maybe it's a question for you to reflect on, how much of your suffering, how much of our human suffering is from taking things personal, is from, even if they are personal, like right? Some shit is actually quite personal. but how much of our suffering is about defending ourself, the ego? And a core part of the Buddha's realization after he meditated deeply and investigated what is going on here and what's the cause of suffering. And he saw the two that I feel like I mostly talk about, which is it's craving for pleasure causes suffering every time. Craving attaches, arises as attachment. And anytime we're clinging, we're attached, we create suffering for ourselves. And so that's a big insight. And then a big part of the Buddha's practice is practicing non-attachment. Attachment equals suffering. Really easy to say. Really easy for me to sit here like, yes, be non-attached and you won't suffer. But fucking hard to train the mind to be non-attached, to let go, to not always be in the craving, clinging, wanting things to be permanent that are clearly impermanent, resisting change. The flip side of that is aversion. And I think I spend a lot of time, because I feel like these are the two most practical tools that we can develop. Buddhism gives us these tools. Okay, here's how we can learn to be less attached, learn to let go. And then the other piece is, here's how we can learn to be compassionate. How we can meditate and train the mind, turning towards pain to be compassionate, rather than the aversive rejection, anger, resentment tendency that we all have of you know, trying to get rid of pain, accepting that some pain is inevitable and we have to, compassion is the wise relationship to pain, the ones that are unavoidable. And the third piece, and what I want to talk about tonight is not being so identified, non-identification with, he called anatta, not self. That so much of what we're taking to be personal, is not who we are, is not our true identity, or not worth clinging to as an identity, maybe connected with the non-attachment. Let go of I, me, mine. One teaching the Buddha says, there's nothing, you can meditate, you can investigate, you'll never find anything in this being worth clinging to as I or me or mine. Which is a pretty fucking radical statement, because we all walk around being like, well, I want to have good boundaries and don't touch my stuff and treat me with kindness and respect and whatever it is that we're looking for. But that upon deep investigation, we can't find the I or the me or the mine, depending on what we're identified with. That's, I like to start by asking you to talk to each other for a minute. So that's the setup, and here's the question. So you can, we're not going to do a long meditation, but you can just allow your eyes to close, and I'm going to ask you a question. It's a repeating question, one of those annoying same questions over and over. But just observe and take note of what your responses are, what your mind says to this question. And the question is, who are you? And you could even ask yourself, who am I? And what does your mind say? What's the response from your heart, your mind? Who am I? I am. And then again, ask, and don't answer it the same way twice. Something else. Who am I? Who are you? Again, asking yourself, who am I? Who are you? And maybe you can even use different words like, what am I? Am I this mind? Is that my identity? Am I this personality? Am I this conditioned views and opinions and preferences? And am I this body? Am I this gender? This ethnicity? This questioning, inquiring, investigating the who, the what. Where is the I? Where is the me? Where is the mine? Asking yourself one last time, who am I? Maybe your mind is just saying this is a stupid question. That's okay. It's not really meant to be answered. Whenever you're ready, allowing your eyes to open. From a Buddhist perspective, we're not trying to, like, there's not a right answer. But it's just an interesting question. I take things personally all the time. But where is that personhood? Where is that self that is so sensitive about how other people see me, how other people communicate with me, how my place is in the community, in the world, in the workforce and the. Now, I find this topic a bit challenging because it's an ultimate teaching. And some of the Buddhist teachings are what is ultimately true. And there's two truths. There's the relative truth of, like, I'm Noah and I'm a white guy and I'm, whatever. I'm a cisgendered white male guy in this incarnation. On the relative level, that's true. And I'm responsible. I'm a parent, and I'm Stevie Ray and Hazel's parent, and that's a role that I play. And like on the relative, there's all of those things. It's like, yes, that's true. I'm a Dharma teacher. It's a role that I play, but it's not my ultimate identity. On the relative level, it's the way that I walk through the world and the way the world treats me and the way I interact with the world. So I don't want to dismiss the relative because the relative is important. And there's a danger in talking about the ultimate nature of reality that is impersonal. So I just want to front load it with, I'm not dismissing the relative. The costume that you're currently incarnated in. And I call it a costume because maybe from a Buddhist perspective, Buddhism believes in reincarnation, and you're not you've been lots of things. If reincarnation is true, it's not like I'm always incarnated as a straight white guy. Lots of different gender identities and lots of different ethnicities and lots of different, kind of through the process. This time around, this is what we're showing up as. But part of this is a bigger context of there's something going on here from a Buddhist perspective that's not just this lifetime. And getting too focused on our identity of just this lifetime is a mistake from a Buddhist perspective. Not dismissing the relative necessity of being somewhat aware of how we are walking through the world and are perceived. And does that make sense? I do want to, because I want to talk about the. And we'll meditate on it, and maybe we'll do a little bit more of that inquiry. I don't know. So since I'm going, I want to keep going. I mean, part of my proposal for you is, what if you didn't take anything per little? Not, I mean, I can't say anything, but had the discernment to not take much personal. Like when someone's giving, criticizing you. What if you didn't take it personal when you weren't getting the loving, kind praise that you would prefer over the criticism? How much of the suffering would that remove if you didn't take it personal when somebody gave you a dirty look, or when somebody cut you off in traffic, or when somebody barely kind to you? Or appreciative of you, or respectful of you, and just kind of just let it non just let it go. How much of the internal suffering would that end? So that's where I want to go with tonight's investigation. Why don't you talk to each other for briefly, maybe just dyads? I don't know how to do that at home, but just briefly, what are some of the things that came up when you asked yourself, who am I? What did your mind say? I'm this body, I'm this mind, I'm consciousness. What did your mind say? And talk to each other a little bit at home. I'll throw you in breakout groups. This is only going to be for a few minutes, so be very concise. Settling, I'll offer a guided meditation, some meditation instructions. So find a way to sit that's upright and relaxed and a posture that you can maintain without much movement. As you're ready, settling in and allowing your eyes to be closed. It's useful to establish a attitude, the intention to be kind, to be friendly, to be accepting, to be patient with your body, with your heart, your mind. The first foundation of mindfulness is the body, bringing present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness to your physical form, to this body. Feel it sitting here on the chair, the cushion. What sensations are present? Investigate. How does the contact with the chair feel? How are your hands resting? Contact of hands resting on your legs or in your lap. This body that we're very intimate with in some ways, that we've been living in, walking around in, aging in. This topic of identification, probably most of us are very identified with the body, this body, these physical sensations, this body that is skin and bones and organs and nervous system, this body that carries around the brain also part of the body, the sense doors also part of the body. And maybe that's the first place of identification. I'm this body, that's who I am. Feel it. Pay attention to it. Observe it. This body that is subject to sickness and aging and death. This body that is so much alive right now, feeling life with each breath, heartbeat. But this body that will eventually no longer be alive will be a corpse. And the Buddhist teaching is that this body is not who we are, it's not what we are, it's just a temporary process. That there's a part of us that is unborn, is undying, unconditioned. As you're paying attention to your body, you can pay attention to the breath. But also, what is paying attention? What is it that is aware? Is the body aware of itself? Or is there an awareness that is aware of the body? It's not just the body feeling itself, but the body held within a awareness, consciousness, a knowing. As you are mindful, present time awareness of the breath coming and going, we'll spend a few minutes just bringing the attention to the breath. Foundational meditation practice, breathing in, know that you're breathing in, the breath is coming and going. Breathing out, know that you're Breathing out. But also investigate, ask yourself, what is it that knows the breath coming and going? It becomes clear that the body breathes all by itself. Even that feeling of, I am breathing. Upon closer investigation, we see actually the body is breathing all by itself. I am breathing is a little bit like I am making my heart beat, or I am making my food digest. It's just what the body does. It breathes all by itself, the heart beats all by itself. The nervous system feels, functions. And the mind continues to think all by itself. Just what the mind does. With mindfulness, we're learning to direct it. Training the mind. If the body is breathing all, then all by itself, who's breathing? If the body's aging all by itself, who's aging? If the body dies, who dies? Turning your attention towards the mind, the third foundation of mindfulness. Seeing how the mind thinks all by itself. Observe your thoughts like bubbles, like clouds passing by. We're so often identified with our views and our opinions, our perspectives, our ideas, what we believe we know to be true and right, what we believe to be wrong, ignorant. Investigating the process of thoughts arising and passing all by themselves, just as the body breathes. Without your permission, the mind thinks without your permission. Where's the thinker? Who's thinking? When sounds call for your attention, you can be mindful of sounds. There's no distraction in this practice. Whatever's happening, it's part of our present time experience. Bring non-judgmental awareness with inquiry. The mind says, I heard that. When really just the eardrums, sound waves, reached the eardrums. The mind consulted memory and named the sound. Oh, that's a car passing by. Or that's Noah's voice, the instructions for the meditation, labeling. It's just sound. The body hears to one of its functions. Mindfulness of the body and the heart, the emotions, the mind, and the sense doors. And the second foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha says, and pay attention to the feeling tone of your experience. What is perceived as pleasant? What is perceived as unpleasant? Or neutral? Because we create a lot of self-centeredness around what's pleasant and unpleasant, what we like and don't like, our preferences. I find that sensation to be unpleasant, so I hate it, and there's a whole self created around discomfort. I am uncomfortable. And the body's just feeling sensations. Or we hear a sound that we perceive as unpleasant. I feel annoyed by unpleasant sounds. Looking at the way that the Mind creates a self around what's pleasant and unpleasant, what we like and dislike. As an interesting experiment, imagine that you were like a foreign consciousness that just entered this body and didn't have names for everything. Didn't have language and memory, but just the direct experience of sensation. Non-judgmental present time awareness of sensation and emotion and this mental activity and emotion. Rather than the memory that says, oh, my knee hurts, and that's from a motorcycle 7 years ago, motorcycle accident. If we let go of the story of the memory and just the sensation, just burning, throbbing sensation, just unpleasant phenomena in the body. The last few minutes reflecting on this teaching on equanimity that says happiness or unhappiness is not caused by what's happening. It's not the sensations, it's my relationship to what's happening. It's not even the emotions or the thoughts. It's how I'm relating to the emotions and the thoughts. My happiness is not dependent on how other people behave, but how I respond to how other people behave. In this life where pleasure and pain are a given, unavoidable, breaking our addiction to pleasure, our aversion to pain, becomes our task. Not being so attached to being comfortable all of the time. In this life where praise and blame are inevitable, learning to not take it so personal, both the praise and the appreciation and the criticism, blame. Because our happiness, our well-being, our freedom from suffering isn't about what's happening. It's about how we relate, how we respond, how much wisdom we can bring to our own minds and bodies, and to our relationships, to walking through the world, this relational world. The less personal we take it, the less we suffer. The less personal we take it, the less we suffer. I'm a big fan of framing what the Buddha taught with the Four Noble Truths as like there's suffering, and it's not your fault. The First Noble Truth is not your fault. It's just the way it is. There's part of taking birth and being a person is that you're going to suffer. It's not your fault. Suffering is created, Second Noble Truth is created by repetitive craving. Craving is not your fault. It's not a lack of character or a sin or a lack of. It's just survival instinct playing through us, just craving for pleasure, aversion to pain, and self-centeredness creates suffering. It's not your fault. It's none of our fault. It's just the way it is. When you have taken birth, you're going to suffer some. You're going to have joy too, and pleasure, and all kinds of fun, interesting dramas are going to unfold. It's not all suffering. You know, there's a mistake to kind of characterize Buddhism as this pessimistic, all of life. It's not what's being said. It's just acknowledging that part of existence is fucking hard, and it's not your fault. And the untrained mind, without meditation, without a practice of renunciation, without some counter-instinctual action, life's going to be harder than it needs to be. And it's not your fault if you don't know how to do it. If you don't, you know, none of us got the instruction manual, or any, you know, and maybe some of us did. I feel like I'm one of the people that probably got a little bit of the instruction manual since my parents were Buddhist meditator folks. But I was like, "Fuck you! I'm gonna smoke crack. I don't want your hippie, feel good, be kind." Meditation instructions. I want anarchy. I want to express my rage. So I'm a big fan, and I hope that this makes sense, that there's a way to hear the teachings as it's not your fault. But the big and there's a solution. The untrained mind, the Buddha called it the monkey mind. The monkey mind will fucking make a mess of your life. It'll be self-centered and fear-based and craving and aversive and, you know, like many of us did, it'll just drink yourself into alcoholism, addiction, without investigation. Never really doing what we just did of turning towards me like, is this a trustworthy source of information? This mind that's been telling me to do all this self-centered, fear-based shit, I've been listening to it my whole life. It tells me to lie, I lie. It tells me to steal, I steal. It tells me to drink, I drink. It tells me to flirt, I flirt. I just obey the mind. And then meditation is an intervention that says, better look at your mind. Better check out, you know, your boss, who you've been listening to, who you've been obeying, and question it a bit. Is it a trustworthy source of guidance? And probably most of us would be like, no, fuck, I've given myself so much bad advice for so long. I've taken so much shit personal my whole life, and I've, you know, and it created all this stress, and it created all this anger, and it created all this low self-esteem, and I thought it was all my fault, and it was all, me. That's who I am. I'm these thoughts. I'm these feelings. I'm these big emotions. I'm these. So part of what I love about Buddhism is that it normalizes the human condition, and then we can get together and, you know, a bunch of heads nod and be like, yeah, fuck, I'm glad it's not my fault. That's a relief. I like it a lot better than them telling me it was because I was born into sin and it's, you know, I have desire because I'm a sinful person. Buddhism is much gentler, less judgmental. Not your fault. It's just the way it is. So if we can take that, not your fault, and if you can, part of my encouragement in this is to try that on towards yourself. I am not my fault. The fact that my mind is self-centered and fear-based and identified with I, me, and mine, not my fault. It's just the human condition. It's not that personal. We are here, Buddhism is here, we are here on a path that is an intervention, that is a way to change that. But in the process of changing our relationship to our minds, to our bodies, to our emotions, it's very important to be gentle, to be kind, to be humble. I don't know exactly what the definition of humility is, but it feels like the right word. Not humiliated, you know, not shamed, but just that sort of like, yeah, man, my fucking mind is an asshole, is filled with self-centered fear. And if we're, you know, anybody's really honest about what's going on inside this ego self mind, it's craving for pleasure and aversion to pain and self-centeredness at its root. And it's what's happening for all of us. And it's not your fault, but it is time to do something about it and to change, and meditation and the precepts, renunciation. And we have this path, this eightfold path that gives us the ability to be less identical. Even just this inquiry kind of meditation, turning towards the mind. Is that true? Are my thoughts true? Yeah, how often do you even question your thoughts? Usually, we have a thought and we're just like, well, I fucking thought it, so that's my opinion and I'm sticking with it. That's my view. I'm probably right. Most of the time, until I figure out that I was so full of shit for most of my life, but now I'm right. I used to be full of shit. Now I'm correct. And just that permission and that encouragement to question and to investigate and to question, like, okay, I have these views and opinions, and I'm pretty sure that it's personal, it. The way that you're treating me is personal. Pretty sure. The way that I think, you know, but just being able to question it and be like, is it true? Are these thoughts true? Are they wise? A huge part of what is necessary in this path to liberation is developing the discernment about what is wise and unwise. Sometimes it's framed in the traditional teachings as what thoughts are wholesome and what thoughts are unwholesome. And the mind does unwholesome thinking all by itself, non-volitional. It's not your fault that your mind does that. But having that discernment, and I actually think that part of the good news is it's not your fault. Part of the bad news is, I think, it's never going to go away. I think that no matter how, there's a in my direct experience, there's a decrease in some of the afflictive emotions and unwholesome mind states, what we would call, you know, confused, ignorant, self-centered fear. There's a decrease. I've seen a massive decrease in my own experience over 37 years of meditation. It works very slowly to decrease it, but it doesn't get rid of self-centered fear. That's just part of our wiring. It doesn't get rid of that. The Buddha And most of you are probably aware of this. The Buddha referred to that part of the mind that does that self-centered, fear-based craving and aversion and taking everything personal. He called it Mara. And in some ways, those of you who are in the room with me, you can see these paintings, like the Buddha's, this, image of that, that's supposedly the Buddha, painting image, and he's all sitting there peaceful. But Mara are these paintings on either side that are these like fierce, and in the imagery, and especially in the Tibetan Buddhist imagery, that's Mara. That's the part of your, right? And it looks like a demon or something, but that's the part of your mind that likes to fuck with you. But the Buddha sits here unperturbed. But it doesn't stop. Okay, for those of you at home, cool demon, those guys over there, that's Mara. It doesn't stop Mara from existing. Buddha's wisdom, being awake, Buddha means being awake. He just knows it's not personal that my mind rages sometimes, or fears sometimes, or craves sometimes, or takes shit personal sometimes. The enlightened perspective is knowing it's not personal. It's just what the mind does. It gets afraid, it gets insecure, it gets judgy. And lets Mara do its thing, rage or whatever, have afflictive feelings and, bears teeth. But the Buddha's unmoved. And the Buddha in the traditional literature says to Mara, I see you. Awareness of, oh, I'm being mindful, I'm paying attention, and I see this is just afflictive emotion arising and passing. I understand its impermanent nature. I understand its impersonal nature, that it's just part of the package. It's not my fault. I fucking, it's a little sacrilegious, but I feel like, the Buddha's, saying, like, I fucking got enlightened. Fault that Mara's still an asshole. It's not my fault that my mind is still afraid and self-centered and judgmental at times. I got liberated. And what liberation does is it changes the perspective. It's not personal when the mind is doing that unwholesome tendency. It's just part of the survival instinct. It's just part of the ego, part of the mind. I, me, mine. Not your fault. But wouldn't it be nice to be unmoved by it and not pushed around in our lives by how, not only, because this is saying, both internally and externally, not pushed around by what your mind is doing, and certainly not, destabilized and, by what other people are doing. What other people are saying, taking personal what other people's views and opinions and attitudes are towards us, or how, the dirty look, oh shit, I think they don't like me. Or, I mentioned in the meditation, praise and blame are inevitable, unavoidable. Learning to not take either of them all that personally, and certainly not become addicted to praise, of needing constant reassurance and looking for and going to the people who will co-sign our shit and say, yeah, you did the right thing, even though we both know I didn't. Because we can find the people that will mostly give us. Right, probably. You find the people that mostly support your bad decisions, praise it, and you're like, yeah, fuck them. You have every right to be angry. You should kill them. They deserve it. You should create all kinds of bad karma for yourself at them. That's a good idea. You should hate them. Fuckers. In a couple places, the Buddha talks about becoming blameless, living a life with renunciation and honesty, and you know, becoming living a life of integrity to the point where we are blameless in the eyes of the wise. The goal is to be blameless in the eyes of the wise, while continuing to understand that you will still be criticized and blamed and judged by those who don't have wisdom. That and the Buddha is an interesting example of an enlightened being. 2,600 years ago, got there, had compassion for all living beings, had non-attachment, had non-identification, saw through the ego mind's self-centeredness, spent his life not only, you know, sharing the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path, but creating these communities where there was a meritocracy that was really radical against the racist caste system of his culture. And so he was empowering people based on their time in the community, not based on their race, and in a culture that is totally divided based on race and caste. So I would also see the Buddha not only as a spiritual teacher and guide and humanist, you know, psychologist, radical psychologist, but also as a political activist, somebody who created a community and supported women creating communities in a time where that wasn't done, and was very, you know, kind of an ally and empowering and quite radical. But he wasn't praised all of the time. Like we think, like, fuck, if there was a Buddha around, we'd be stoked. But imagine, I mean, and even imagine in this culture, if there was a Buddha, people would not care for him. Actually, we'd probably lock him up. Probably think he's crazy. Oh, you have compassion for all living beings? Fucking culty. But in the Buddha's time, he had a lot of conflict and a lot of blame and a lot of attacks and accusations, and he was not beloved. He was blamed a lot for disrupting the religious system of his time, for empowering and speaking out against racism and sexism. And so you get a lot of hatred when you're coming from wisdom. Sometimes you get a lot of blame. And it's important to know that and accept that and not take it personal, not think like, oh, well, if I'm a good person with integrity and wisdom, then people will like me. Actually, people will judge you. People without wisdom, people with wisdom will be like, yep, sounds good to me. People without wisdom will feel threatened somehow by disrupting power structures that people want to hold on to. This teaching that says there's nothing worth clinging to as I or me or mine. Not even this body, not worth clinging to as I or me or mine. Not even, certainly not our views and opinions, our personalities, not worth clinging to as my view. And how much suffering do we get into about clinging to, even when we're right? When I feel like nothing means even when you're right, even when it's wisdom, even when it's wholesome, even when it's true, still not worth suffering about being right. And that when we're truly in, I don't know, confidence and knowing, when we know what's right and what's not right, what's true and what's not true, you don't have to cling to it. You just know it. You're not super attached to everyone else agreeing with you or also understanding what's true. Not worth it. You don't need to cling to it. If you cling to it, you'll suffer. You'll get into all kinds of conflicts with the people who don't understand, people who don't know. So this not worth clinging to as I or me or mine. And our, like maybe our material, thinking about your material stuff. So the body's not worth clinging to, the views, opinions, the not worth clinging to. How about your stuff? Should you cling to your stuff? Now, many of you have seen me, so clinging is this, right? I like to use my hands as, clinging is holding on tight. It's grasping, it's gripping, it's attaching, clinging. And so what's being said is don't do this. And non-attachment sometimes we think of non-attachment as like, well, if I'm not attached, I'll be detached. I'll be separate from, it's almost like avoidant. Like a non-attachment is like, well, fuck that. That hurts. So fuck that. But actually, non-attachment is connection. And this teaching is not saying there is nothing worth being connected to. Even connected to as I and me and mine, be connected to your stuff. Like, yeah, that's my stuff. That's my motorcycle. Please don't steal it. I'm not going to cling to it when you do steal it. But I'm not going to try not to suffer too much about it when it breaks down and when our stuff is subject to impermanence and sickness and aging and death, just like the body. Connection rather than clinging. And finding that line between non-attachment and irresponsibility. Because sometimes even when I hear myself talking about, don't take anything personal, it can go a little too, if we take it too far, it can become irresponsible and it can become flaky and it can become, don't be attached, but lock your doors. Don't be attached to money, but like save for retirement. so that we don't get too, don't use these, non-attachment, non-identification, ultimate truths in ways that actually don't serve us in the relative world and in our relationships and with our stuff and with our finances and with our relationships. There's a Sufi, maybe it was from Rumi or one of those Sufi poets that said something like, trust Allah, trust God, but tie up your camel. Yeah. And one of the things I like about Buddhism is how non-theistic it is. But one of the things I like about Islam is that they have that saying, if it's God's will, they say inshallah about everything. And I really like that because this humility that like a plan, you say, hey, I'll meet you for dinner, inshallah. With this humility of like, if it's God, what they're saying is if it's God's will. And I like that kind of in the non-attached, non-delusion that like, that certainty that we bring to our plans. Sometimes when I'm trying to make a plan with one of my teachers who's been a monk for decades and decades, I'll say, okay, I'm gonna come to the retreat. I'll see you in Thailand in December. And he'll say, that's the plan. And he'll never say, yes, I'll see you there. And it's that similar to like, if our, I guess in Buddhism, we'd say if the karma is right, Not if it's God's will, but just that humility of like, we don't fucking know if we're ever going to see each other again. We can make a plan, but this might be it for us. To have any sort of certainty, any attachment to an outcome, any expectation is a mistake. To really believe that what we think is going to happen, what we plan to happen, has to happen in order for us to be happy. And have a little bit more of that attitude of like, yes, let's make plans. It would be great if that happens. I'd love to see you at the retreat. That's the plan. But I can't guarantee it. I know that things are too impermanent and too uncertain and too unreliable to know that that outcome is going to be experienced. Same teacher. One time I was saying goodbye to him. I was saying, see you later, or I'll see you soon, something like that. And he paused me and he said, just say goodbye to me forever. He said, because, I mean, we want to live in reality, right? We're practicing Buddhism. We're practicing wisdom. We want to live in, you know, the reality is we might not ever see each other again. And the comforting idea of I'll see you next time. I look forward to seeing you again. And you can, you know, it's a bit, he got gentler over the years. And he's, now he just says, that's the plan. But at that time, he was giving me this teaching opportunity. And he said, just say goodbye forever. Let's let go. Let's let go of ever needing to see each other again. Let's enjoy the time that we have had and the connection that we've had and not expect it to continue, not need it to continue. You know, with a sort of, you know, enough kindness to say like, yes, that's the plan, but also let go. Let go of needing that to happen. At the end of the meditation, I said the equanimity, our happiness or unhappiness is not dependent on what's happening. It's dependent on how personal we take it, how we respond to it. And this is a pretty radical perspective. It's, of course, normal and not our fault that we take things personal and that we think, well, I'm in pain, that's why I'm unhappy. But what's being said here is that you can change your relationship to pain so much that pain is no longer a problem. You have compassion for it, and it doesn't create unhappiness in your life. And impermanence can be understood so deeply that it's not a problem if it's goodbye forever, because there's not clinging to cause suffering about it. It's not the not getting what you want or losing what you want to keep. It's the clinging and the aversion that cause suffering. And it's very different than the way we think about, I'll be happy when I get, rather than I have the ability to be happy, at ease, peaceful, equanimous, no matter what's happening, getting, losing, getting praise, getting blame, famous, infamous, ill repute, successful, failure. Not the source of happiness or unhappiness, but how we relate to our failures, how we relate to being criticized, how we relate to it definitely causes our internal sense of well-being or happiness or unhappiness. And we have these practices, the meditations, the mindfulness, the loving kindness, the compassion, the forgiveness, the equanimity. We have the precepts, the renunciation. We have a map here of how to train the mind so thoroughly that you can navigate the joys and sorrows and praises and blames and pleasures and pains and losses of life without suffering so much about it. And slowly, gradually, over the months and years and decades of the Buddhist path, you'll see, oh, this shit works. I suffer a lot less than I used to. It might not be skillful for me to say this, but I feel like I suffer about 10% as much as I used to. That my suffering has decreased by 90% from 37 years ago when I was a drug addict locked up and I started meditating. And it felt like life was mostly suffering, like 98% of the time. I was in craving, I was in aversion, I was in self-centeredness, I was in violence, I was in survival, hungry ghosts. And then, so some of that's like getting sober helps for sure. But then even my first couple of years of sobriety, just not doing drugs didn't take away my self-centered fear. My first couple of years of sobriety were a lot of suffering. And I started meditating, but I hadn't quite developed the skill to not be so identified and believe. And my mind kept saying, you should fight that guy. And I kept fighting that guy. And my mind kept saying, you could probably get away with stealing that. Well, I stole that. Because I was continuing to obey I was like, when my mind would say, you should take some drugs, I'd say, nope. But that was like the only boundary I had with my mind was I'm not gonna pick up no matter what. But I'll fight you, I'll steal from you, try to seduce your girlfriend. No ethics, no real renunciation, just because I wasn't using. That took time. That took for me years to learn ethics and to become less identified with my mind and more willing to be uncomfortable. Learning that from sitting still and being uncomfortable. Few minutes for questions or clarifications or just some I just want to one last time say the less personal you take stuff, the less you'll suffer. That's the sort of overall what I wanted to say tonight. Cake, please, you can go first.
I really like what you said about never seeing people again, when you're saying bye, because I've been saying bye to everybody because I literally might never see you guys again. I'm moving to Texas. And then, so I've been saying it to girlfriends, like, hey, give me a hug. We might never see each other again. But I mean it. I've moved a lot. It happens a lot. And it's not bad. It is what it is, right? And I find myself fearing. Okay, the real fear, I'm just fearing I'm an asshole. So I was glad that you kind of touched on that. And then the other thing was I've been feeling lately like it's really okay. All right, so I'm driving out to Texas, and I don't know, man, who knows what's gonna happen, but I'm okay with not making it there. And I was like, that's kind of weird. Because I've always had really big goals and I need to do this, I need to do that, and like, but I've done some really cool shit and I've met some really cool people. And I came to California literally to sit and meditate with a bunch of people and stop feeling crazy, and it worked. So now I'm here's the weird, like, little creepy brain part that popped. Is, oh, I really feel okay with what if I don't make it to Texas? What if I don't know, explode or come across a yokel cop who sucks and and then I go, oh, you're gonna will yourself into dying young now because you're okay with dying now, So I get this fear that acceptance, like without that like drive and need for the next thing, I might die. Now that I'm saying it out loud, it sounds crazy, so I regret it. Yeah.
I mean, it is a, I don't know if I can repeat the whole thing. I'm not sure if you could hear at home. And you hear me talk about this a lot. It's an important question of like, where's the line between non-attachment and non-attachment to existence? And you should not be too attached to existence because you're going to die. We're all going to die. It's part of why the Buddha said, do these five daily remembrances. He says, say to yourself every day, I'm subject to sickness, aging, and death. Remember that every day. Don't think that you're exempt from dying. When we don't know when we're going to die, but to not be too attached to, but there is a line between attached and being maybe it's subtly suicidal. With that sort of like, I know I'm gonna die, and I kind of hope I die sooner rather than later. And maybe not even consciously, but some of my behaviors look a little, extra reckless. Not only am I non-attached, I'm seeking dangerous, like there's one thing like driving cross country, you're like, okay, I'm gonna take I-40 or I-10 or wherever you're taking over there. And then there's probably, more reckless ways of like, and I think I'll stop in this really dangerous neighborhood, and I think I'll sleep in my car in the ghetto in Albuquerque on the way and see what happens. It looked cool in Breaking Bad, and so it's kind of like, well, I was just driving to Texas. Well, actually, I pulled off at the truck stop and, whatever, kind of like putting ourselves in danger. Not just anything can happen, but we have that some relative responsibility of being non-attached and being, it is wisdom to know that it might be goodbye forever. It's wisdom. And it is okay to do that with an open heart and with the vulnerability of like, and if I never saw you again, that'd be sad. I would like to see you again because I like you. I care about you. But I'm open to that reality being part of it rather than needing the denial of no, for sure. We're going to stay in touch. We're going to totally go on vacations together and I'll meet you in, Houston or whatever. Like that kind of needing the security of a fantasy plan. Rehab friends, dude, we're going to forever. I feel like I never had this experience, but I feel like the experience of signing yearbooks. I never had a yearbook, never graduated a high school, but I feel like there that's something like we're gonna like forever, like fucking San Dimas High forever. To that part, I will say that I don't know, but I don't think so. And I personally, I don't believe in the manifesting or kind of creating stuff at all. You have your karma, and shit happens that you didn't manifest, that wasn't even your karma, that was just part of being in this culture. That's not your fault, that's not personal. And I don't think that fear of death is necessary, that actually just it's the difference between attachment and connection that I was getting into early. Like, stay connected to life. Stay connected to being responsible for your health and your fitness and your well-being. And like, don't get so non-attached that you're like, I'm so non-identified with my life that I'm just gonna eat junk food all the time. I was like, no, like be connected, like eat the green stuff and do the movement and do all of the good, healthy stuff and still don't be too identified with your body as who you are. Because you can do all of the right things and have all of the and still, live you can live your life afraid of death and you're still gonna die. So I think it's totally safe and that we actually live in a enough of a survival instinct. That even, I'm certainly not enlightened, but the Buddha didn't, he wasn't afraid of it and he didn't die. He lived till a ripe old age. I think it's totally safe to be non afraid of death, to accept it. Please, question here? Yeah.
Yeah, I was curious. A lot of the meditation that I've been doing is you know, it's about bringing stuff to the surface that you're aware of, right? So I feel as if it's about what's in your awareness to an extent, or maybe what is a little bit below your awareness, but maybe not quite fully subconscious, but it's bringing to your awareness. So my question is, around things that are very subconscious, like if you have a very, very subconscious desire that just starts driving you, like recently I've been becoming, I guess, increasingly more goal oriented when the point of meditation has been to try to not be so goal oriented, but I feel like it's almost at a subconscious level that I may not even be fully aware of in meditation. It just, I kind of notice it a couple days later, like, wow, the last 3 days I've been very driven by this thing. And I, even in meditation, I didn't really notice it. So I don't know what Buddhism has to say about maybe like the deepest subconscious things that drive you that you may not even be aware of, and kind of how to get even deeper into all that if you've been doing all the stuff like meditating and everything like that.
So the question is about the subconscious, unconscious, underlying motivations that we're not necessarily aware of in real time, but see, like, oh, I just woke up of, you know, 3 days of chasing. I wasn't even aware that I was doing that, and now I look back and see it. Here's how frame it, is that mindfulness, vipassana, insight, meditation that we're primarily doing group is called a path of purification. And it's a process of the, we haven't been seeing the nature of impermanence, the repetitive craving, the self-centeredness. We haven't been aware that that's what's been driving us. And then mindfulness shines more and more light on it and shows us the layers and layers and layers of, I really take everything personal all the time. I really am constantly, every, you know, that sort of practice of like realizing that the body won't move at all except for craving for pleasure. Every movement, every time I blink my eyes, every time I swallow, every time I breathe, it's this repetitive craving for, oh, that would feel better to take a little stretch. Oh, that was craving for pleasure. But so there's just layers and layers of that are revealed. And the purification takes time. Meditation, first you see the surface. You start meditating, and in the first months and years, you see everything that's at the surface, the low-hanging fruit. And then you keep meditating, and you start to say, oh, there's more under here. Oh, there's more under here. There's more under here. There's subtle layers. I heard one teacher say that even 30, 40 years into practice, he felt, you know, the image of a iceberg? That 10% of an iceberg is what we see. 90% of an iceberg is submerged beneath the water. And that sometimes our process of awakening is like that. There's the 10% that we're aware of, and then there's a whole bunch of stuff that we're not aware of yet that keeps getting revealed and keeps getting revealed, and, you know, whatever other analogies, layers of the onion and all of that that we just keep peeling back. I like to think of that path of purification of like a clogged toilet and meditation as a plunger, and remembering that all of that shit that's backing up the pipes has to come back up into the bowl before you can flush it through. You plunge it, it comes back up. And then, and so you see, and you go, yep, bunch of shit in there. And it's unpleasant, and it smells, and oh, there's my fear, and my craving, and my self-centeredness. Gross. I'm fucking gross. Oh, well, I'm glad I'm not my fault. And then, you know, the purification happens, and the pipes get cleared, and the toilet of your mind flushes more easily. We're all toilets. I know there were a couple more questions, but it's 8:30, so I'm going to end it there. If it's brief, I'll try to. But we're, yeah.
Well, you tell me if it's brief, otherwise we can stop.
Yeah.
Talk about doubting the monkey mind.
It's yeah.
Monkey part of meditation. One of the hindrances, and my hindrance that I struggle the most with, is skeptical doubt. That's part of the reason why I'm mad.
Yeah.
So I was just curious about if you could talk a little bit about the difference and how to discern properly. You know?
Can you come next week?
Yeah.
I'll do the hindrances and doubt and talk about it next week when we have more time. Okay. Goodbye forever. And since this is the last time you'll ever be donating to Against the Stream, be extra generous, because although we will never see each other again, this meditation center will continue without any of us. I guess that doesn't really work. Anyways, class is done by donation, $25 suggested donation. Please be generous. If you can't afford, you know, a $20 or $25 donation, give what you can, including those of you at home. Please help support the nonprofit organization, support me as a teacher, support Sebastian as our employee that facilitates all of this happening. The 5-day silent meditation, if you really want to plunge your toilet, go on retreat. And the purification that happens in the silence is a much deeper look at our unconscious stuff and what's beneath the surface. There's a retreat the 13th, May 13th through 18th, 5-night silent retreat. So that's 2 weeks from tomorrow. It was sold out, but we've had a couple of cancellations and we got a couple of extra rooms. So there is some space still. People can still register. There's some single rooms available. There's some double shared rooms available. So if you want to come and you have the time and resources and ability to come, there's a little bit more space. We gave a bunch of scholarships, and I have I'm a terrible business person, and I tend to give away too many scholarships, and then we don't make any money, and it kind of costs us money, so I can't give any more scholarships away. I already gave a bunch away, but if you can afford to pay for it and come, please join us for the 5-night silent retreat. And if anybody here has resources and can't come, but wants to donate some money so someone else can come, there are more people on the scholarship list that we haven't been able to give a room. And so probably a $500 donation would cover somebody's, I think it's 600 actually, but five or $600 would cover somebody's ability to go to the retreat if you have that kind of resources and want to donate. Please consider that. Whole five, beginning to end. It's a whole process. May any goodness that comes from our practice, our merit, and help us awaken and not take things so personally. May we all become more free. And may we share this outward in all directions with all beings. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. Goodbye.
Forever.
Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.